everyone, how are you? This week I've been hiding in a caravan on a small island off the south coast of England, busy preparing for the imminent launch of our EdTech Podcast Festival app for all who are coming along. I've just got back in from a blustery 4 mile walk in time to give a big thanks to new event Learn It for joining as our latest sponsor, and to the legendary Nate Langson from Text Message Pod and Bloomberg Tech as our latest speaker confirmation. It's going to be an amazing day. This week, we're in conversation with Sharon Liu, Policy Advisor for the Office for Educational Technology in the USA, whose particular focus is increasing access, decreasing cost, and improving outcomes for all students and adult learners in post-secondary education. I spoke to Sharon during my trip out to South by Southwest EDU, and we cover off topics including how the Office for EdTech are reimagining and identifying what students look like, how the office can pursue innovation whilst being responsible to the taxpaying public, and how new partnerships can be formed across traditional and non-traditional educational players to the benefits of learners. If you're interested in the art of nudging, smiling, the use of chatbots in higher education, or changing methods of accreditation, keep listening. And if you like this episode, you may also be interested to check out our upcoming episode with Professor Ian Martin, Vice Chancellor at Anglia Ruskin University in the UK, and Cameron Mirza, Head of Transformation at the University of Bahrain. That's all from me. Have a great week, and thanks ever so much for listening. I'm here with Sharon Liu from the US Department of Education Office of EdTech and Senior Policy Advisor. And if I understand correctly, your specialism and your area of focus is higher education. And our interview today follows a presentation yesterday from Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of State for Education at South by Southwest EDU, which was a surprise visit and a big talking point of the event. So thanks very much for joining the podcast. I guess the first question really is just for our listeners to find out a little bit about who you are and what you do and what your day-to-day world entails, I suppose.
Yeah, so thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. My name is Sharon Liu, and as you just said, I'm a senior policy advisor in the Office of EdTech. And let me just, what does that mean? So the Office of EdTech is a policy shop. We are a small group within the Secretary's office. We're made up of, I guess, mostly career staff with a couple of political staff. So a lot of us have been in our jobs for about 2 to 4 years. And our job is to actually ask a question about technology and education policy. So if you think about all of the important education policy issues that people are concerned about, and at the department, we're very concerned about, you know, providing access for education for all students and thinking about the particulars of that. You know, is technology the right tool? If it is, how should we use it? And, you know, what are the other conditions in place that would make it successful? So, for example, you know, within a school, it's not just, you know, airdropping a new piece of technology or a new game and assuming that students will automatically learn better. It's working collaboratively with teachers, with principals to provide professional learning for them, training for how to use the tool, working with the developers to think very meaningfully about what evidence do they have that their particular piece of technology actually improves student learning, what outcomes do we want to see, sort of that conversation. In the post-secondary space, very similarly, not just focused on the classroom, but thinking about, you know, does it transform our system of education so that we are actually serving our students?
And what are the big things that keep you awake at night? So what are the big problems that, you know, through policy you're trying to solve, I suppose?
I think one of the main questions, and something that I'm actually a little bit encouraged about that I've seen as a trend, is like properly understanding the students that are in post-secondary education. So a lot of people, and myself included, right, when we first approached education policy in higher education, we thought, oh, well, I went to a university. I also went to graduate school. So I've spent quite a lot of time in post-secondary education. I must know everything there is to know. But the truth is that, and the statistics bear out, that most of the students that are in post-secondary education have what we call affectionately non-traditional characteristics. So they have a job that's either part-time or full-time. They either take a part-time load, so not even full-time, or they take a full-time load and they work full-time, right? They have dependents, so like one or more like children or elderly parents that they care for. And, you know, there are all these things about them that are that we know to be true, but we still gravitate towards the image in our minds, right, of an like of what we were. We were 18, our parents dropped us off, we hung out late at night at the dorms and ate pizza. But that's actually not the luxury that most people that we are trying to serve have. And so I think more and more you're starting to see a conversation around, you know, the role of community colleges, the role of short-term training. And I think that's really important because really the people that need post-secondary education are the ones that are being lost through the system because they can't dedicate the time and the resources to that experience.
So that's very interesting because, I mean, during the session with the Secretary of Education, one of the questions, I suppose, one of the discussions was the CEO of edX sort of saying, you know, could part of meeting the needs of those students you just described be more around, you know, whether it's funding mechanisms for short form courses and things like that. So I don't know whether you're, you know, there's something that you're looking at in terms of how do you support that more ad hoc learning, which fits in around your everyday demands as well, whether that's caring and then learning and then juggling all of these pieces.
That's an excellent question. And something that we actually think about quite a lot. And so sort of the foundation for, you know, any of our approach is that the money that we spend, whether it's through grants or loans to students, is actually taxpayer dollars. So there's a big part of this where we have to provide for students who don't have the opportunities themselves. So we want to do that. We also want to be accountable to taxpayers for how the money is spent. So the question is, how can we be innovative in our policy instruments, right, but also be responsible? You know, one of the tools we have is something that we call the Experimental Sites Initiatives. And that allows us to, on a very limited basis, test what would happen if we waived some of the requirements of Title IV for student financial aid. And the main sort of question here is, you know, does that enable us to serve more low-income students or more students that are in traditionally underserved populations? And we have been doing this for a number of years on a limited basis. We have about a dozen or so experiments that are ongoing. I'll just give you a couple of examples. Like one of them is an experiment that asks the question, you know, if you allowed high school students while they're still in high school to be in dual enrollment programs with community colleges leading towards, you know, a degree or on a degree pathway, and you gave them Pell, would that encourage more students to transition from high school to college and then complete like whatever 2 or 4 year degree? So that's an ongoing experiment. We've been experimenting with various competency-based models, so subscription-based tuition, especially for students who are in programs that are rolling admissions, right? Not the traditional, you know, summer, spring, fall scenario. What if it was limited direct assessment, where if I assessed you in a very open and transparent way, that you knew how to do, you know, addition, would you then get to skip that remedial math class? So we're experimenting there. But our most recent experiment, and one that I think I'm particularly excited about, is called EQIP, which is basically asking the question, can a traditional institution partner with a non-traditional education provider, one that's not accredited, to provide the kind of in-demand education that students would need for success in the workforce, but not necessarily have access to? And can we then set up a system where we evaluate the quality of that non-accredited program to see what, you know, like that's different than the traditional accreditation, right? So our accreditation system that Anant talked a lot about is a proxy for evaluating the quality of programs, right? So we trust you as a university to provide a quality education if a third party accreditor says that your program is high quality. But, you know, that system of evaluating university doesn't look at the particulars of new and sort of innovative programs, programs that are short term, programs that didn't exist when the accreditation system was set up. And obviously, we can't get rid of it wholesale because that would be in the category of, you know, baby and bathwater. But what are the lessons learned? What do we need to know about how to evaluate the new programs in this limited way, right? So we just have five programs that are ready to enroll students within the next year. And what then can we extend to larger policymaking about regulations and innovating and adapting to the workforce needs?
Interesting indeed. And so the government is looking at actually extending that accreditation system essentially. And will it be in the form of an app, or will it be, and when will it be out
okay.
there?
So let's rewind a little bit. I'm not saying that we're blowing up accreditation, because I'm going to get in all kinds of trouble for saying that. What we're looking for is, like, what are the ways to evaluate the quality for new programs that don't fit within the traditional mold? And we're hoping through our experimental sites to have information. So we just started thinking about the information collection and what outcomes would we measure for not just the programs, but for how the programs are being evaluated for quality. So in that conversation, we're really excited to, you know, just be thinking like, this is our opportunity.
And what kind of time scale are you looking at as well? So, because obviously everyone listening will think, oh, fantastic. When might that actually kind of get rolled out if it's deemed to be a success?
So we have five sites, which are five partnerships with institutions, non-traditional providers, and quality assurance entities. Actually, some of the programs are with boot camps, and some of them are with workforce training. So I think that two or three of them will begin to start enrolling students within the next few months. And then as students enroll is when we're going to get information about how well do the students do under these conditions, what should we be looking for. So I guess it's faster than government normally works, but still glacial compared to how people listening to this podcast may want it to.
Yeah, interesting indeed. And so your role, so essentially it's a civil servant role, is that
yes.
correct? Yeah, just so I get my head around how it works. So on that front, how did you get into your role? I mean, I think you spoke a little bit before about, I think you've been there about 2 years or so?
Yeah, so I've been at the Department of Education for 2.5 years. And before that, I was at the Department of Labor. So I'm one of those people that is not working in the area in which they studied. So I studied molecular genetics when I was in school for quite a long time. And I also studied econ. And then I was like, hey, I think I'm ready to have a job and not be studying anymore. And the one thing that I was super good at was working with data. So I went to an agency that was very concerned about data and worked a lot with data sets that were about workforce and the effects that, you know, trade and other economic conditions had on domestic workforce.
And what was your experience of education, and, you know, what were the memorable bits, and what's been, you know, the most impactful educational experience that you think you've had, learning experience, whether that's formal or informal?
So I hope that a lot of people have given you inspiration when they answer this question. I will say the most impactful experiences were actually when I was not doing well, where I had a terrible experience in grad school. And so I guess it was the first time, like, I have been so conditioned just because of my, like, background, like my parents and my family. There was like this track. You were in school and then you were in more school and then suddenly you had a job. And it was sort of like when I didn't do well for the first time in grad school was when I asked the question, like, why am I doing this? And like, what actually do I need for my life? And so that was interesting and impactful.
Yeah, because it can be quite a shocker if you're suddenly thinking like, oh, this is not going the way and the trajectory that I thought it was going to happen. But it's not the end. It's just, you know, what's coming next and how to reorientate yourself, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was a series of conversations with people about like, well, what actually are you good at doing? What do you enjoy doing? And then very practically, because you need to eat and live somewhere, like, you know, how would you manage to change your skills for like employment? And so that is how I started to think in that way.
So my kind of layperson's understanding of the Office of Educational Technology is I interviewed previously the now CEO of ISTE,
Richard.
Yeah. And so was he there when you joined, or he had already? Yeah.
So I think I worked for Richard for about 6 months.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, one of my questions, I've had various people on the podcast before. One person I interviewed was from MIT, and he was talking about whether, you know, edtech's at risk of chase to the bottom in terms of value and, you know, thinking about universities. And in the UK at the moment, we have a big discussion around the value of university. And at the same time, we've now got the teaching and excellence framework, which is more student-centred. So where you have the traditional rankings, which are very research-focused, also now thinking about how we're using new technologies or teaching practices to change what university or higher education might be like from a student perspective. So I just wondered how that kind of discussion around value and I suppose, applicability to the workforce is playing out here, and also what you see in terms of the research within your own team as well on that discussion.
So I think I mentioned this earlier. I'm excited that we are starting to acknowledge that our students are not who we thought they are, because I think that is a very important tool. So even probably when you talk to Anant, edX was this grand vision, like free education for anyone who wants it. And when they started looking into their data, they realized the people that were actually completing were actually people that were already in college anyway and whose parents were relatively affluent. So we were giving more tools to people who already had opportunity. And it wasn't actually doing the thing we wanted it to do. Not that the tool itself was bad, but it wasn't thoughtfully implemented in a way that could support those students. So as an agency, we've started to think just this past reporting cycle. Typically, we collect data on institutions based on first-time, full-time students. We've started to collect non-first-time, non-full-time, because, you know, out of recognition that non-first-time, non-full-time is actually a lot of the students that are in our institutions. We have lots of students that take a few classes at community college, take a break, work, come back. They would never be captured in statistics. And that makes our schools look like they're performing worse than they actually are. And then we turn that into a hammer when we make policy decisions about who gets funding or acknowledgement. But I think that I'm like pretty encouraged that people are starting to use that as a discussion about how might we best take our system away from an institutional approach to a more student-centered approach. So thinking about, for that population of non-first-time, non-full-time, or first-gen students, like what are the support services that they would need? And how can we guide them successfully as they navigate?
It's really interesting because I was interviewing the founder of 2U yesterday. Mm-hmm. And he was pointing to these kind of support services as one of the highest cost centers within universities. And where does the line draw in terms of who provides that support? So it's quite an interesting area, you know, when we think about the cost of universities and online versus offline, and also the mental well-being of students, you know, as they're experiencing this. So I don't know if that's something that you've kind of looked at as well.
Yeah, so, you know, there are not, and when I say research, I don't mean that there are, you know, these randomized control trials that have been done for the past 5 years, you know, just, you know, studies. There have been studies that have led us to some really important information, right? So, you know, a little bit of nudging, right? Whether it's a text messaging app or, you know, something that, you know, wraps up the data so that a counselor can make a call or, you know, and I know that these are not the sexiest technologies, right? But these are technologies that have made it easier for us to understand our students and provide them the things they need when they need them. So I like those in the sort of non-VR, AR, AI, although AI is like really, really helping to do this well. So I think one example that is often used is how Georgia State has closed the achievement gap for students that are, you know, African American and Hispanic in their communities in the Atlanta, Georgia area, just even by using an AI chatbot where people can sort of feel like they can ask questions and not be judged for the questions or find the information they need. There are some communities in St. Louis where that same population of underserved students, you know, throughout the summer, this idea of being admitted in June and then showing up on campus in September. Like, what do you need to help them, like, come to the first day of class? And just very small things that are an application of technology that is not fancy, but that does do very, very important things.
Yeah, the nudges. Yeah, we love nudging in the UK in our cabinet department for nudging. Really interesting. So final question, I suppose. We always ask people on the podcast, you know, who inspired them, and it doesn't have to be in your particular role, but anyone that's kind of influenced the way you think or conduct yourself, your kind of outlook on life. And then also if you have any books or other resources that you would like to share with our listeners that you think would be of interest as well.
Okay, so I'm really not good at the who inspired me question. I'm sorry about that. So let me think while I'm talking. One of the resources that our office puts out is called the National Education Technology Plan. And it's sort of the, I guess, quote unquote, technology policy for the United States of America. And so we have two versions. One is, we call it the NETP because it's long, that focuses on K-12. And that looks at teaching, learning, and assessment within the class, as well as leadership and infrastructure. And the idea is, as you're transitioning from traditional learning to digital learning or digitally enabled learning, like what are the conditions that would enable success? And in addition to like us making some observations, I think by talking to people, we include about 50% examples of districts and schools and states that have implemented transformations well and some of the lessons learned, so that as you're a reader and you're an instructor or a teacher or an administrator, you can hear the voices of your peers sort of giving you their lessons learned. So that's an important thing that we put out as a resource for K-12. Last year, we released a version that was post-secondary education, following very much the same structure, but asking a slightly different question, right? So yes, we need to improve teaching, learning, and assessment within a classroom, and we need to have, you know, nudging technology. But actually, technology actually can transform the way that our entire system of higher education acts. So right now, we are very much oriented around institutions. But could there be, in a way for students to be guided along individual pathways throughout their lifetime, right? So in K-12, you are in sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, but in your life, you change multiple times. And what information do you need to take your skills that you have and exchange them for either additional education or workforce opportunities? And how can that most benefit students that are traditionally underserved by the system?
So that's very interesting, because when I think about the sort of political landscape, both here and in Brexit, and I won't get into the details of it, but yeah. I don't know if this is within your remit, but looking at, you know, how do you think about exactly what you just described in terms of serving the population more in their 60s and, mm-hmm. you know, needing to upskill, and as we live longer, needing to engage in that, and who picks up that? Is it the universities, or is it alternative players in terms of online learning or face-to-face learning? Because we often focus on the sort of younger demographic that are coming up, but actually there's this huge learner population out there that can not only learn and for their own enjoyment, but actually be an active and continually participatory part of society as well. So I don't know if it's something that, you know, is outside of your remit in terms of that age group or
No, definitely. Definitely not. So traditionally, the offices of career, technical, and adult education have been separate from the quote-unquote post-secondary education office that focuses on traditional 2 and 4 year institutions. But I think more and more the conversation about lifelong learning mixes the two, because yes, we need to improve the 2 and 4 year institutions, but more and more, as you said, we need to make education and training available to people throughout their lifetimes after they're 22.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other thoughts on the inspirational person?
Okay, so this, I'm not going to name names, but I had a boss tell me once that this was in the context of, you know, speaking in public and being in public, that I needed to smile more, because what he said to me was, when you're the federal government, you need to be knowledgeable and accessible. And you can know all of the things in the world, but if you are not accessible, then people will not feel like they have connected with the people that are supposed to be providing them services. So I don't know that I still smile enough. I think I'm still pretty grumpy, but I think I will close by saying that I would love for people to reach out to me. And I tell them this, tell me like what you think that our office and the department can do to support the work that you do. Let me know how, you know, we can improve.
Fantastic tip. And for everyone listening, there's a big smile opposite me, which is great. I think I'm probably the opposite. I probably smile a lot, but don't always know what I'm talking about. So fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Sharon.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode. That's all from me, apart from to say, if you enjoyed the blockchain in education episode a few weeks back, then you should check out the Be Masterly course on blockchain, which I recently took part in. You can register with promo code EARLYBIRD20 at checkout, and the link is in our show notes. Our friends over at EdSpace are also having a rooftop party on the 13th of September in London. Link and password are in the show notes too, and the team behind Emerge and EdSpace always throw a good party with an interesting and mixed crowd. So if you are listening from London, be sure to be involved. If you like this week's show, feel free to tweet, drop us a note on iTunes, or email us direct. Other than that, have an amazing week. Bye-bye.